This tape is a production of All Roads Ministries. Its title is Martin Luther, and it deals with some of the writings, views, characteristics, and attributes of that famous person. It is the view of this tape, and it is generally the view of All Roads Ministries, that intelligent, knowing Protestants cannot be considered Christians. And no matter what we define as Protestant, certainly Martin Luther is one of the key figures in the so-called Protestant Reformation. So therefore, an examination of him, even in this cursory fashion in this tape, is certainly essential to determine the claims of Protestantism to be Christianity, and therefore the claims of a Protestant to be a Christian. It is the basis of this tape, and I shall establish this claim, that Martin Luther was in fact the first prototypical Nazi, and that he was not a religious reformer, but an anti-religious person who opposed basic Christianity in both its virtues and its teachings. We shall establish this mainly by quoting from Luther's own works, and by quoting from, or at least making reference to, two works dealing with Martin Luther. One considered, by definition, quite favorable, as it is written by a Protestant author, and the book itself calls the subject, that is Martin Luther, a great reformer. Secondly, a book which takes a far more critical role, which was written by a Roman Catholic layman. Once it is established that Martin Luther is not, in fact, a Christian hero or a reformer, but instead pretty much the exact opposite, it will remove one more underpinning of the claim of Protestantism to be, in fact, a reflection or a part of true Christianity. Again, Martin Luther is, just to place him in his proper category, the closest things that Protestants have to a canonized saint. His life, his writings, his goals, his determinations, his experiences are held up for emulation or at least admiration in the same sense that the Roman Catholic Church upholds the activities, virtues, and lives of various canonized saints. Therefore, if one can point out, as I will, that Martin Luther is not deserving emulation nor admiration, then once again the whole judgment faculty of Protestantism becomes seriously questioned and totally compromised. This is the reason why ARM has devoted a 60-minute tape to the subject of Martin Luther. To get into the subject proper, allow me to deal with the incident which probably is best known of Luther's life. And if you have been raised a Protestant, or if you have read Protestant documents, it is usually presented to you in this fashion. Martin Luther stands before the Diet, that is the assembly of the Holy Roman Emperor. He stands there, all alone, on a wooden floor, in coarse monk robes. He is arrayed before the majesty and power of medieval Christianity. Men who have great power, great learning, great support, and a tremendous hierarchical structure are arrayed in sumptuous robes, in jewels, in magnificent garments, and Martin Luther stands before all of them. And upon being questioned upon his beliefs, he issues his famous statement, "Here I stand, I can do no other. God help me." This is the statement which characterizes Martin Luther. Even those who know nothing more of him know this much. Therefore, as a starting point, let us examine the circumstances involving this. Again, if we may, let me set the picture psychically. Again, if you are a Protestant, you have been told that this was one of the ultimate confrontations of history. This is the confrontation between medieval superstition, oppression, and tyranny, versus liberty of conscience, versus intelligence, versus knowledge, versus pure Christianity, versus a more basic approach to God, tearing away at the superstitious nonsense that had been built up over the centuries. And those princes and cardinals and bishops and abbots and priests and nobles, all arrayed against this one man, Martin Luther, all somehow sensed that this was the great moment in history, and that after this moment, their power power would be destroyed forever. They would no longer enthrall men's minds with nonsense, but man would freely approach God. I believe I've done as fair as possible a projecting of us back into this setting. In other words, the mindset of the Protestant who writes about this or thinks about this has been described validly. Now let us deal with the reality. Again, with this in mind, let us examine those key words. Notice the words. Here I stand. I can do not otherwise. This is Martin Luther's ultimate argument to the objections raised to his religious approaches by those he has dealt with. In other words, Martin Luther ultimately falls back on the value of the individual over the value of the organization. This is the setting of his most famous moment in his life. One might justifiably quite call it the climax of his life. The problem with this setting is that it is false. The problem with this is that the brave Luther presented here was not brave. That the Luther who allegedly refuted the arguments of the Roman Catholic defenders did not, in fact, refute their arguments. And in fact, there is no record that Martin Luther said the words which were attributed to him, the words which, in the view of many Protestants, changed the course of Western civilization for the better, forever. And this is quite characteristic about Luther. Much, if not most, that concerns Luther, that was written about him in his lifetime or afterwards, that presents him in his favorable light, does not appear to have any true basis in reality. It was either distorted or propagandic, pure propaganda that is, or it was simply fabricated by some of his defenders. Now my sources for these claims, these statements, are not, as I've stated before, some vague, minute, hidden bit of documentation that has recently come to light. It is not some hidden letter that has been found stuffed away in a book somewhere, but commonly written, commonly read, frequently published books available to you who listen to this tape today. And I suggest that if you find this tape upsetting in one form or the other, that you do your own research about Luther and find out the truth about him, as I did. As with all ARM products, we do not expect you to put your faith in a man. We simply expect that you will be persuaded by truth, logic, reason, and fact. In this case, if you doubt the facts, go and look them up yourselves. They are available for all of us. Understand, if you will, before we continue any further, the significance of what I've just said. What I will expose in this tape about Luther is readily available to anyone who wishes to do the research or simply go to a library and take a few books out. Yet the mythology surrounding Luther, the canonization of him, the lies and distortions of his lives, his views, his acts, his character, his vices, have been carried on from the time of his first revolt until today. Those who have done the research apparently still continue to do so, as there has not been a debunking of the Luther legend, at least not by Lutherans or Protestants. Therefore, these people continue to pass on what they must know to be false. They praise a man who is not worthy of praise. They advocate a man who is not worthy of imitation. And they follow a reformer who could not reform himself, but in fact advocated committing sin. Why, one must ask, are there still Luther's defenders? Why are there still Luther's advocates? Why do they still exist? Why do they still teach? Why do they still advocate? Why do they still write? That is, as Orm has pointed out in other tapes, the nature of Protestantism. It is not interested in truth. It is interested in fabrication. Because if it becomes interested in truth, as the ugly man looking in the mirror, what it will find about itself is disconcerting and upsetting and uneasy. And uneasiness leads to activity. So better to remain, so they hold, in their own ignorance, in their own lies, in their own denial of truth, in their own denial of the ability to determine truth, better to remain in that wallow of vice rather than attempt to determine truth, virtue, and God's will. But, as I've stated before and will state again, this is primarily the nature of contemporary Protestantism. And, if Luther is any example, it was the nature of Protestantism from its very birth. My primary source in this research was Here I Stand, A Life of Martin Luther by Roland H. Banton. Mr. Banton is a relatively well-known Protestant author. And I quote this book, or at least I use this book, for several reasons. One is because Mr. Banton could not be confused or accused of having any kind of Romanish tendencies or prejudices. Number two, the book is, at least to my knowledge, very commonly available and a quite popular one. Therefore, if any reader should feel inclined to follow up the statements made on this tape by checking its source, they may be able to do this most easily by using this particular book. A second source which I utilized is a book entitled The Facts About Luther by Monsignor O'Hare, the most recent edition being republished by Thomas A. Nelson Publishers. The Monsignor, of course, could be accused of having an anti-Lutheran bias, as he is a member of the Church of Rome. However, if one reads this book, one will find that the Monsignor restricts himself almost exclusively to Protestant sources in writing about Luther. In other words, he talks about what Protestants say about Luther. He quotes what Protestants say about Luther, and very seldom will take what a Catholic says about Luther. So therefore, both of these sources are, as far as one can determine them to be, impartial and objective. Also, The Facts About Luther is primarily a series of quotes from Luther's own works and then commentary on them, with a great deal of documentation and source material. Because of that, and because of the time limitations on a tape like this, I will not, therefore, quote beyond these two books. Again, I suggest if you are upset by what you hear in this tape and wish to refute it or wish to confirm it, that you simply obtain either or both of those books or many of the others that have been written about Luther and simply examine them yourself. After all, since we present truth, we are not disturbed by your desire to confirm what we state on this tape. A few further comments. Understand that Mr. Banton's book is written favorably, that it is written to praise, not to bury Martin Luther. Therefore, the negative facts that are brought up in Mr. Banton's books are those which are unavoidable, that is, which cannot be avoided and must be explained away. And the attempt Mr. Banton makes, although heroic at times, to explain away the negative facts of Luther is very interesting. It will also be pointed out that many of the negative aspects of Martin Luther are merely alluded to, and his exact quotes or his actual words are not given because, as is obvious, Mr. Banton is attempting to write a favorable book. Therefore, occasionally, the facts about Luther, the second book, is needed to balance the picture presented of Martin Luther. Allow me at this point to return to the incident I mentioned in the beginning of this tape, mainly Luther's appearance at the Diet. Now understand, the Diet here was a convocation or a congress, and Luther's presence here was essentially a trial in which his religious views, his principles, his methods, etc., would be examined. His prosecutor, or his opponent, whichever way one wishes to look at it, was a gentleman named Eck. And I shall now quote from the chapter in Mr. Banton's book called Here I Stand. Now remember, Luther is attempting to defend his views while Eck is attempting to oppose them. And I think that this is really enough background for you to understand the appropriateness of this quote.
Reiterated one question from the previous day. Eck asked, "Do you defend them all, or do you reject a part?" Now, what we're talking about here is Luther's works, his books, his pamphlets. I continue. Luther reflected aloud. Note now, he didn't answer he reflected aloud. Do you want between reflecting aloud and answering? I don't, but perhaps Mr. Banton can explain that. The author seems also to know that what Luther said was said as a reflection. Wouldn't God's grace enable man to stand bravely and boldly where he should stand, rather than simply reflecting on what his answer should be? But that's an aside. I return to the quote. And this is Luther's answer. This touches God and his word. This affects the salvation of the soul. Of this Christ said, "He who denies me before men, him will I deny before my Father." To say too little or too much would be dangerous. I beg you, therefore, give me time to think it over. End of quote. Dangerous? How would it be dangerous? If it were for Luther's body for which he feared, then he is simply a coward. For a man who fears for his body when the question of salvation is involved is nothing but a coward. If it were that he fears for his soul, then why did he write things which he is now afraid of explaining and defending? For if they are dangerous or wrong or blasphemous or erroneous or lies, then they are dangerous to his soul. He doesn't even know which. He is afraid of defending or rejecting some of his works. He wants time to think it over. Now, Luther had had an awful lot of time over a year before the Diet of Worms actually was convened in which he could explain things. Now, according to this book, all of this took place in the Diet of Worms in 1521, and Luther rebelled publicly on October 31st, 1517. The first invitation was sent to Luther on November 28th, 1519. Now, on April 17th, 1520, that is 2.5 years after his original rebellion, and 4.5 months after his invitation to appear at the Diet of Worms, Luther is still not prepared to answer the simplest of all questions. Was what he wrote what he meant, and can he defend it? Instead, he asks for another day of reflection. I guess he will reflect aloud in his room. Apparently, he could not anticipate that they would ask him if he was going to defend what he wrote. Somehow, Luther didn't realize this is what the subject of the Diet of Worms would be. Now, on the next day, according to the chapter, he replies that, and I quote, "Unless I am convicted by Scripture and plain reason, my conscience is captive to the Word of God. I cannot and I will not recant anything. For to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. God help me. Amen." Now, I continue reading in the same chapter. "The earliest printed version added the words, 'Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise.' These words, though not recorded on the spot, may nevertheless be genuine, because the listeners at the moment may have been too moved to write." End of quote.
Notice the key point here. Mr. Banton makes it clear that he has no actual record of the transcript giving Luther attribution for the famous words, "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise." In other words, it only appears much later, apparently as an addition. Mr. Banton argues that since they may have been left out because someone may have been moved, therefore they may exist. In other words, from a possibility, we now go to a truth. This is not historical research. This is not historical fact. This is pure fantasy, pure speculation. If the words were said, why would the official recorders not record them? Well, Mr. Banton advances the argument that these people were very moved. Which, of course, if one were to apply this argument throughout history, is very interesting, even in the pure situation of Scripture. Obviously, the more moving words of Jesus were not recorded because those who listened to the more moving words of Jesus were so moved that they immediately forgot to write them down or forgot them for all time. This is one of the basic problems that the Protestant has to deal with when he deals with Luther. In other words, he must fabricate, he must fantasize, he must speculate, but he cannot deal with the straight facts. And I think this example is a perfect example of the dealings that Protestants have done with Luther. Let us not deal with the facts. Let us not deal with what is recorded. Let us not deal with what happened. Let us deal with what may have been, should have been, could have been, would have been. But let's not deal with the facts. After all, if we are Protestants, we don't have to be concerned with the truth, because we have our own private interpretation of not only Scripture, but also history. But that's the nature of Protestantism, isn't it? The point here, and it is essential to my argument, is that when one deals with the facts of Luther, one must hide them. When one does not have facts, one makes them up, for this is the only way that he can be presented in a favorable light. Now, let me give another example of this. As those of you who know anything about Luther knows, at a certain point in his life, as a relatively young man in his 20s, he entered a convent and took sacred vows to remain forever a monk and later a priest in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, it is obvious, either he took these vows with a clear conscience, knowing what he was doing, and therefore violated most sacred vows taken before and upon God, or he didn't really mean them to begin with. In other words, he was a very good Catholic who broke his vows, therefore is not credible, because if he breaks his sacred vows, how can he believe in anything else? Or he was a liar to begin with, having lied about the seriousness of his intentions to become a monk and then a priest. Mr. Banton deals with this in an earlier chapter, dealing with this exact issue, and I shall quote.
A few sparse items of evidence are adduced in favor of this explanation that Luther was being dishonest and had taken the vow and perjured himself. I continue. They are not of the highest reliability, because they are all taken from the conversation of the older Luther as recorded, often inaccurately. The scholar means the word invalidly, not inaccurately, but I continue. By his students. And even if they are genuine, they cannot be accepted at face value, because the Protestant Luther was no longer in a position to recall objectively the motives of his Catholic period. End quote.
Please notice what Mr. Banton is saying here. He's saying that we cannot believe the Protestant Luther when he talks about the Catholic Luther, nor can we believe the Protestant Luther when he talks about Catholicism. So either one of two things. Either Luther remained a Catholic all of his life, and somehow there is no such thing as Lutheranism or Protestantism today, and we all know that's false, or we are not to put our faith, trust, or belief in the words of a man who can no longer be objective about that which he has left and about that which he criticizes and attempts to reform at the same time that he leaves it. Notice again the point. Mr. Banton has stated, in academic roundabout terms, that Luther is not credible about religious motivations, about Roman Catholicism, and about his own religious feelings, desires, goals, and vocations. If he is not credible on these matters, what can he be credible in? And once again, I remind you, listener, that Mr. Banton's book is favorable, not critical of Luther. There is a second point to Mr. Banton's quote in the earlier part, that his words were recorded inaccurately, so he states, probably by his students listening to him talk around the table. So in other words, once again, as in the Diet, where Luther's words were apparently said but not recorded, now they were recorded but not said. So we have two choices. Either we can totally be convinced that whatever he said was written down by someone else because Luther didn't say it, or if we can totally convinced that whatever was recorded is something he didn't say. And if you've gotten slightly confused, notice the point. We're talking about academic scholarship, research, and facts, historical facts. And one of Luther's main advancers, his biographer, a person who remains a Protestant to this day, to my knowledge, if he's still alive, advances the point that we simply cannot believe the sources we have that come from Luther's mouth or are written about him. From that, one could an honest man conclude, absolutely nothing. All he has is fabrication, fantasy, legend and myth, but no facts, no history. It is a common contention among Protestants that Luther did not found a new religion, but merely reformed the old one, that is, the Roman Catholic religion, which somehow went astray or got off the right track and went into error. Now, the point is this. According to Mr. Banton, we can't believe what Luther said about Roman Catholicism. So therefore, how can one reform that which we cannot know anything about? We can only reform something if we know about something. We can only reform something if we are part of it, or can evaluate it, or have a standard by which to evaluate it. And we can only call a person a reformer if we know what he is reforming, how he went about, what his methods, his goals, his purposes, and what his results were. Now, the results are easy to judge, and they're absolutely horrible, but that's, if you simply look at the history since 1521, you've seen that things have gotten much worse than they were before that time. But that's an aside issue, and I'm not dealing with it here. But by Mr. Banton's own admission, we cannot evaluate Luther's words, views, as either being those that he said, or even if they are what he said, we cannot evaluate them as being impartial or objective, but apparently only the rantings of an old man. Now, how could we possibly consider him a reformer on this basis? No one can. No one should. Unfortunately, many still do. We're still dealing with the basic issue here of why Luther became a member of the Catholic clergy. What were his motivations? If he was, in fact, motivated by a pure, honest reason, that would be one thing. If he were motivated instead by something dishonest or less than pure, then perhaps we could argue that he was valid in ultimately realizing his maladjustment as a monk and leaving. Now, since this deals with a basic religious issue, and since it deals with the character of the man, let us examine it a little bit more, again from Mr. Banton's point of view. There is some evidence, he states, that Luther took the vow in order to escape, essentially, an unhappy childhood or maladjustments in his family life, that is, at home and in school. Dealing with this, I again quote from Mr. Banton, the first chapter.
There is really only one thing which connects the taking of the cowl with the resentment against parental discipline. Luther is reported to have said, "My mother caned me for stealing a nut until the blood came. Such strict discipline drove me to the monastery, although she meant it well." This saying is reinforced by two others. "My father once whipped me so that I ran away and felt ugly towards him until he was at pains to win me back. And at school, I was caned in a single morning 15 times for nothing at all. I was required to decline and conjugate, and hadn't learned my lesson." Now notice, first of all, we're told there's only one statement, and then we're told there's three, because there's two that support the one. But number two, he specifically says that such strict discipline drove me to the monastery.
Notice the point here. Mr. Banton states that there is no reason to believe this is true because Luther states it only a few times. Now the point is very simply this. If Luther is telling the truth about his motivation on entering the monastery, then it doesn't matter if he says it once or many times. And if he is lying, it doesn't matter whether he says it once or many times. The basis of a person's actions should be based on the validity of his words, not their frequency of occurrence. But again, we are dealing with a Protestant scholar dealing with a Protestant subject, and the rules of validity do not apply. At this point, please turn over to side two, where this tape will continue. Thank you. Martin Luther, Arm Production, side two. The issue we dealt with at the end of side one was the motivation for Luther entering the monastery, and by his own admission, and of course at the denial of his major biographer, Mr. Banton, he entered it because he was beaten both in school and at home. He was driven to it to simply escape pain, maladjustment, terror, or whatever else he felt, which of course would imply an unbalanced and a psychotic personality, if not psychotic, then merely neurotic. Of course, this is borne up frequently in Mr. Banton's book and dismissed as saying that Luther could not have been mentally ill because he always showed a capacity for hard and copious work, although I do not understand the difference. That is, I do not understand why hard work automatically excludes mental or emotional illness. nor do I think this is Mr. Banton, but this is the only defense he can offer for why this odd behavior in his apparent hero. Allow me at this point to present the evidence for one of my first charges, that Luther is the spiritual founder and father of Nazism. Allow me to define the term. Nazism is a form of socialism that was practiced by Adolf Hitler in Germany in the 20th century. It claimed to be a form of fascism and was characterized by a sense of German national superiority, a totalitarian view that is a worship of the state by which the state required man's first, last, and total loyalty, an advocacy of violence, and an anti-Jewish ideology. Now, we shall establish that all of these characteristics had their roots in Luther's teachings and personality. The first, which is most obvious, is that Roman Catholicism, as any historian will tell you, always advocated a non-church religion, a non-church state religion, that is. And the history of the papacy, especially in medieval times, was one of constant conflict with the state, whether that state be a king or an emperor or a duke or simply a local nobleman. The division of man's loyalty was civilly to the state and religiously to the church. Luther changed this. I shall now quote from Banton's book, chapter Rebuilding the Walls, subsection Politics. Those who sit in the office of magistrate sit in the place of God, and their judgment is as of God's judgment from heaven. And, a second quote, if the emperor calls me, God calls me. In the chapter to church tutorial, and I read, hence Luther's plea that the Catholic schools be replaced by municipal schools with a system of compulsory education, including religion. In other words, end quote. In other words, Luther advocated that the state teach religion. Notice the first quote. Certainly sounds like it could come from Adolf Hitler, making the magistrate equivalent to God, making the emperor equivalent to God. Couldn't it? No, these are quotes from Luther. And notice, he advocated that the state teach religion. I wonder how one can square this with his alleged claim for freedom of conscience. As to the charge of German superiority, I quote from Banton's book, the chapter, The Measure of the Man. When one comes to take the measure of the man, there are three areas which naturally suggest themselves. The first is his own Germany. He called himself the German prophet, saying that against the papist asses he must assume so presumptuous a title, and he addressed himself to his beloved Germans. The claim is frequent that no man did so much to fashion the character of the German people. End quote. Dear. As to the charge, or the basis of anti-Semitism, I quote from the book Facts About Luther, in the chapter Free Will and Liberty of Conscience. Luther asks, what are we to do with this rejected damned people of the Jews? I will give my honest advice. First, their synagogues or schools are to be set on fire, and whatever will not burn is to be covered and heaped over with earth, so that never again shall one find stone or cinder left of them. Secondly, their houses are likewise to be broken down and destroyed, so that they do exactly the same in them as they do also in their schools. Therefore, they may perhaps be allowed a roof or a stable over them, as the gypsies are, in order that they may know they are not the lords of our country, as they boast to be. Thirdly, all their prayer books and their Talmuds are to be taken away from them, in which such idolatry, lies, curses, and blasphemies are taught. Fourthly, their rabbis are to be forbidden under pain of capital punishment to teach any more. Fifthly, the Jews are to be entirely denied legal protection when using the roads in the country, for they have no business to be in the country. Sixthly, usury is to be forbidden them. All of their cash, their treasures of silver and gold, are to be taken away from them and to be put aside to be preserved. And for this reason, all that they have, as we have said above, they have stolen and robbed from us through their usury. End quote. The words speak for themselves. This is not Adolf Hitler speaking. This is Martin Luther writing, advocating, advancing, and preaching. Doesn't sound like a great religious reformer to me. Does he to you, listener? I now turn to the concept of advocacy of violence. There was, during Luther's earlier preaching years, a tremendous present revolt in Germany. The common consensus of historians is that the peasants, rightly or wrongly, were inspired by the teachings of Martin Luther. And Luther, in his writings, did in fact advocate violence for both sides. I shall give a few quotes at this time.
I read from the Facts About Luther, the chapter Luther, a Fomenter of Rebellion, and I quote, this is Luther saying this, "Whoever shall assist and lend his personal influence, means, and reputation that the episcopate be destroyed and the rule of bishops be exterminated is a beloved son of God, a true Christian, an observer of God's commandments, and wars against the ordinance of the devil." When the peasants rebelled, attacking among other secular lords, also the bishops, Luther stated that this peasant man, quote, has ample reason to break forth with the fail and the club, unquote. Yet he later wrote, concerning the same rebellion which came out, that the lords had a perfect right to attack and kill the peasants. And I quote from his position on that. "To strike in, to strangle and stab, secretly or openly, for in the case of a man in open rebellion, everybody is both chief judge and executioner. In other words, everybody should attack and kill the peasants after the peasants are justified in taking up armed rebellion." In the same chapter, and again from the same tract, entitled Against the Murderous and Rapacious Hordes of Peasants, I quote, "Whatever peasants are killed in the fray are lost body and soul and are the devil's own for all eternity. The authorities must resolve to chastise and slay so long as they can raise a finger. Thou, O God, must judge and act. It may be that whoever is killed on the side of the authority is really a martyr in God's cause. A happier death no man could die. The present time is so strange that a prince can gain heaven by spilling blood easier than another person by praying." Another quote, "Let whoever is able help in the slaughter. Should you die in the struggle, you could not have a more blessed death."
Notice, here Luther is clearly advocating violence, killing, slaughter. These are his actual, clear words. There is no sense of forgiveness, no request for reconciliation, no desire for peace. Instead, he makes it a moral obligation to go to war. He has made war, in essence, a sacrament. Again, this is later what Adolf Hitler also preached. He did not come from a moral or theological vacuum. He was the spiritual inheritor, that is to say, the spiritual son of Martin Luther's beliefs. What we have established, therefore, from his own words, is that the characteristics, the distinctive characteristics of Nazism, were found first in Martin Luther's writings, in his theology, in his advocacy, in his preachings, and in that location, approximately 310 years later, they came to fruition, blossoming forth in the person and the beliefs and the activities of Adolf Hitler. It is clear, dear reader, become a reader, dear listener, and read it for yourselves. One may at this point wish to defend Luther by quoting other passages where he will oppose obeying states or oppose violence, and I will agree that if one searches Luther's writings, one can find some evidence to sustain this. But the point is quite simply this. If Luther writes contradictory things, then at one point he is wrong, and how are we to determine when it is the right Luther or when it is the wrong Luther? I also point out that evil men, such as Adolf Hitler, will search the writings of anyone to find some attempted moral justification for what they do. If Luther is not consistent in his writings, if he contradicts himself, if he takes different positions on different moral issues, then one thing, and one thing only, we can be sure of. He is not to be trusted. He is not a reliable source. He cannot be trusted to tell the truth, because he either does not know it or he does not care for it. But in either case, he cannot be considered a religious reformer. I also made the charge that Luther could not be considered a religious reformer for various different reasons. His preachings and his personality, his personal characteristics, are irreligious. Let us deal with a few specific issues here so that I may establish this. If one thing is clear about Christianity, and as one thing is clear about the words of Jesus, that is that poverty is superior, or at least a easier, less of a stumbling block for salvation, then riches. In other words, Jesus makes it abundantly clear throughout that his message is primarily to the poor, and that it is good for a man to renounce everything, give up everything, become poor, and follow Jesus. Therefore, Christianity must, if it is to follow the words of Jesus, advocate poverty, if not for everyone, then at least as superior to riches. What does Luther say on this? I quote again from Bantam's book, the chapter, Rebuilding the Walls.
And Luther, despite his contempt for the Franciscan vow of poverty, was himself a Franciscan in the prodigality of his giving. Luther was opposed to the spirit of capitalism. The abolition of monasticism and the expropriation of ecclesiastical goods, the banning of poverty as either a sin or at least a misfortune, if not a disgrace, distinctly stimulated the spirit of the economic enterprise. End quote. Now notice this.
Luther bans poverty as a disgrace, a misfortune, or perhaps even a sin. That is the exact opposite of the Christian point of view. How can Luther maintain it? Or, better yet, how can those who advocate Luther as a reformer maintain this despite his words? Notice also, in the quote, he has contempt for the Franciscan vow of poverty. But of course, St. Francis derived this vow of poverty from the words of St. Matthew. He opened the Gospel and he read. It's interesting that he read from St. Matthew, while Martin Luther, according to legend, read from the Epistle according to the Romans. Perhaps Martin Luther, had he read from St. Matthew, would have understood the proper relationship of poverty and Christianity. He did not. He opposed Christianity on this issue. What were Luther's view on the nature of God, that is, on divinity itself? Well, again, let us take the work done by Mr. Banton, and I quote from the chapter called The Middle Way. This deals with the disagreement between Luther and Erasmus, who was, at that time, a Roman Catholic scholar, and they were corresponding and disagreeing over the nature of God. But let Mr. Banton explain it.
This deals with the disagreement between Erasmus and Luther. Beginning of quote. But this was precisely what the natural reason of Erasmus would not concede. He, Erasmus, perceived that the conflict lay between the power and goodness of God. He would rather limit the power than forfeit the goodness. Luther, the reverse. End quote.
Notice, Luther would rather consider a God who is all-powerful rather than a God who is all-good, because somehow Luther cannot conceive of a God who cannot exercise his power. This, of course, is why he ultimately denied free will, because a God who creates us with free will, by definition, restricts voluntarily his own power over us, allowing us to choose either good or evil. But this does not compromise his goodness at all. Notice what Mr. Banton is saying. Luther will have an all-powerful God who is not all good. A God who is not all good cannot be a Christian God, and anyone who claims this must, by definition, become either a blasphemer or an atheist. These are not the qualifications for a religious reformer. Let us now examine, although only briefly, some of Luther's views on morality. Once again, we're quoting from Mr. Banton's book.
I continue. The chapter is No Other Foundation. The subtitle is The Menace to Morals. In the field of morals, many felt that his preoccupation with religion was dangerous. Nevertheless, the charge was not altogether perverse. Luther did say things at times which emphatically sounded subversive to morals. The classic example is the notorious "Sin for all you are worth, God can forgive only a lusty sinner." To make this the epitome of Luther's ethic is grossly unfair, because it was a piece of uproarious chafing of the anemic Melanchthon, who was in a dither over scruples of conscience. Luther's counsel was essentially the same as that given to him by Staupitz, who told him that before coming so frequently to the confessional, he should go out and commit a real sin like parricide. An aside here, Luther was told no such thing. No Catholic priest would ever tell someone in the confessional to go out and kill his father. but notice the comparison the author is making. I continue. Staupitz was certainly not advising Luther to murder his father, and Luther knew well that this his jest would not include the impeccable Malthazon to jettison the Ten Commandments. Luther was saying merely that it might do him some good for once to spoil his record. End quote.
Notice what the author is saying. He's saying that Luther jokes about morality, and then says, however, he is clearly nonetheless saying that his friend Malthazon would be better off if he spoiled his perfect record by sinning. In other words, Luther clearly advocates sinning. There's absolutely no way around this. A man advocates evil. A man advises that evil be done. A man advises evil so that God will forgive him. And somehow this man is called a religious reformer. Anyone who advocates evil cannot be called that. On this issue a little further, I shall continue reading.
This is a point which Luther did make at times, that one sin is needed as a medicine to cure others. An aside, notice, sins are now needed. I continue to quote, an unblemished record endangers the worst of all sins, pride. Hence, a failure now and then is conducive to humility. But the only sins which Luther actually recommended, now notice this, the only sins which Luther actually recommended as record spoilers were a little overeating, overdrinking, and oversleeping. Such controlled excesses may be utilized as the antidote to arrogance. He did say something else with an unethical ring, however, namely that good works without faith are idle, damnable sins. Erasmus was horrified to hear integrity and decency so stigmatized. But Luther never meant to say that from the social point of view, decency is no better than indecency. What he meant was that the decency of the man who behaves himself simply for fear of damaging his reputation is in the eyes of God an idle, damnable sinner, and far worse than the indecency of the contrite offender. Luther's statement is nothing more than the characteristically paradoxical version of the parable of the penitent publican.
No matter how he tries, Mr. Banton cannot explain away the fact that Luther is calling good works sinful, and he's advocating bad works, evil, as opposed to good. This cannot be considered anything even close to a religious reformer. The proper word to describe such a person is blasphemer. Listen again, dear reader, or dear listener, if you haven't yet fully comprehended what he said, they need no comment from me. Luther advocates sin. He requires sin. Sins are needed. This is his theology. This is his view of God. This is the God he worships, one that requires sins and thinks that they are good. As further evidence in this advocacy of evil, I will quote from the chapter Here I Stand, again in Mr. Banton's book.
And we're talking about the attack on Luther that he would oppose all civil authority. Luther replied that he intended nothing of the sort and would counsel obedience even to evil magistrates. End of quote.
Once again, Luther would require evil acts when done to obey magistrates. Notice the defense offered in the Nuremberg trials by many of the Nazis. I was simply obeying the lawful authority placed above me. People condemned those people for using that as a defense. Some of them were the same people who somehow advocate Luther as a big paradigm of behavior. Luther says we should obey evil magistrates. Yet, somehow, when the Nazis did it, people opposed them. Luther was, of course, advocating something totally opposed to any Christian view of God, of conscience, of sin, or behavior. But then again, Luther, obviously, was not a Christian. There is more, listener. I shall now read from the book The Facts About Luther in the chapter Free Will and Liberty of Conscience. Listen to his own words again.
This is a quote from Luther. Man is like a horse. Does God leap into the saddle? The horse is obedient and accommodates itself to every movement of the rider and goes whither he wills it. Down the reins, then Satan leaps upon the back of the animal, which bends and goes and submits to the spurs and caprices of its new rider. The will cannot choose its rider and cannot kick against the spurs that pricks it. It must go on, and its very docility is a disobedience or a sin. The only struggle possible is between the two riders, who dispute momentary possession of the steed. Then is fulfilled the saying of the psalmist, I am become like a beast of burden. Let the Christian, then, know that God foresees nothing contingently, but that he foresees, proposes, and acts from his internal and immutable will. This is the thunderbolt that shatters and destroys free will. Hence it comes to pass that whatever happens, happens according to the irreversible decrees of God. Therefore, necessity, not free will, is the controlling principle of our conduct. God is the author of what is evil in us, as well as what is good. And he bestows happiness on those who merit it not. So he also damns others
who deserve not their fate. End quote. Now notice what Luther is saying here. Number one, God causes evil. Number two, he is unjust. He condemns those who do not deserve it. Sounds like very strange words, don't they, from an alleged Christian reformer? But they are his own words. I shall read further from the chapter, Luther as a Religious Reformer. Notice the basis of his morality, or more properly, his immorality.
We must, he says, remove the Decalogue out of sight and heart. Another quote. If we allow them, the commandments, any influence in our conscience, they become the cloak of all evil, heresies, and blasphemies. Another quote. If Moses should attempt to intimidate you with his stupid Ten Commandments, tell him right out, chase yourself to the Jews. End quote. This is the same man who acts as a moral teacher, one who says that the commandments should have no effect on our conscience, and that you should not listen to the Ten Commandments given to Moses by God. You should simply make some anti-Semitic slander. This man claims to be a Christian. Again, these are Luther's own words.
What are Luther's views on chastity and on sexual morality? Again, I will quote from the chapter, Luther as a Religious Reformer.
I read from the chapter, Luther as a Religious Reformer. Chastity or continence was physically impossible. End quote. Another quote. The gratification of sexual desire was nature's work, God's work, and, as necessary, I much more so than eating, drinking, digesting, sweating, sleeping. In other words, one must have sexual gratification. It is impossible to remain under control.
How do those who claim to be Lutherans today possibly ever advance that their people should not have sex outside of marriage or before marriage, when the founder of their own religion says that it is impossible to avoid it? This is strange considering the normal Christian view. But then again, Luther could not be considered a religious Christian reformer. And what about those who, as Jesus says in St. Matthew's Gospel, take a vow to remain celibate for the sake of the kingdom of God? Does Luther have any comment on this? Yes, he does.
Another quote. Hence, to vow or promise to restrain this natural propensity is the same as to vow or promise that one will have wings and fly and be an angel, and morally worth about as much as if one were to promise God that he would commit adultery.
Notice, once again, Luther puts himself squarely opposite the words of Jesus Christ. Notice, Luther says that celibacy and adultery are morally equivalent. What a strange view from someone who claims to be a Christian. Do you understand why I called him a blasphemer? I shall now deal briefly with the situation of Philip of Hesse, who was a political and military supporter of Luther. He, for some reason, wanted two living wives at the same time and sought from Luther permission to have this polygamy situation approved of by a Christian leader. Luther, examining the support that Philip had given him, decided that he would do so, but did so secretly, telling that Philip that he must not make public the permission that Luther had given him. With this in mind, listen to the quote from the book, The Facts About Luther. The quote is from the chapter, Luther as a Religious Reformer.
And this is a quote from Luther. A secret yes must remain a public no, and vice versa.
In other words, to Luther, it depends how something is said, whether in public or private, whether it is true or not, not the words itself. In other words, truth has no value, it is totally relative, and lying is totally allowed. if done to assuage the sexual desires of one's political and military and financial supporters. Again, Luther cannot be considered a reformer. There is no need for me to repeat the words over and over and over that Luther has said. My claims are, in essence, that he founded the moral basis for Nazism, and, two, that he was a blasphemer, an opponent of God, not a Christian. I have not dealt with nearly all, or nearly most, of the information which is available in these two books alone, and there are many, many books written about Luther. But I shall like to close this tape with one, what I consider, interesting observation. When one looks up in the index of the book of Mr. Banton on the morality, one sees a cross-reference saying, see ethics. And this is definitely the best epitaph of Luther. For morality are those laws and those rules given by God to man which are never changing, which reflect the will of God for man. While ethics are those rules fabricated by man to explain how a man should behave properly in a civilized fashion within different contexts and within different civilizations and different cultures and for different professions. In other words, ethics is an endlessly changing man-made thing, while morality is God-imposed and immutable. Notice that the index of this book says that when you want to look up morality, instead you see ethics. This truly is the legacy of Luther. When you want to know truth, look up relativism. When you want to know the rules of God, look up the feelings of man. When you want to know the nature of God, look up the twisted mind of Martin Luther, who says that God causes evil, that he's unjust, that he's not all good. This is the man that is advocated as a religious reformer. He is instead a blasphemer, an enemy of God, which he also states in some of his other writings. And, of course, none of his writings, or at least most of his writings which were given in Table Talk or recorded in the Table Talks dealing with the comments on the papacy, are allowed to be expressed by any civilized man today. They are too gross, too crude, too vulgar, too obscene. But not as obscene as Luther's view of God and Luther's view of Christianity. There it is, dear listener. I suggest you obtain the books and read them through yourselves critically. You'll see the words of Martin Luther are far more damning than anything I accuse him of. That is the man, Martin Luther. That is the man who was the first and the key Protestant. And that is the man whose spiritual sons today still deny truth, still advocate evil, and still, unfortunately, lead souls astray from truth. Additional copies of this tape may be obtained by writing to All Roads Ministries, that is ARM, 38 Charlotte Grove, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. At that time, you may obtain a catalog which will show you all the other products we have available at this time. The most related tapes related to this tape are the Protestant View of the Church, Protestantism and Sin, and the Protestant View of Truth. We suggest you obtain them as aids in your further study in these matters.